For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
A possible turning point for Venezuela today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Shots fired today in Caracas as Venezuelan security forces clashed with opposition supporters. This woman in Caracas is worried about what happens next.
I am scared that things will get more violent, but I think that somehow there is no other way. If we want to be free again.
Also, tour packages where people volunteer in orphanages around the world are increasingly popular and lucrative.
When you see a young white person with a baby who's being fed, it's just one of the ways that elicits emotion and allows people to give.
We explore the ethics of volunteer tourism, those stories, and much more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Shots were fired at protests in Caracas, Venezuela this morning. One man was killed as military and police forces allied with President Nicolas Maduro clashed with opposition protesters. Venezuelans posted videos of the protests to social media. That was just hours after waking up to the news that an opposition leader, Leopoldo Lopez, said he had been freed from house arrest by members of the military who dropped their allegiance to Maduro. Lopez is allied with Juan Guaido, a fellow opposition leader who's led the fight against Maduro for the last 4 months. Today, Guaido called on Venezuelans to take to the streets once again to oust Maduro.
The armed forces, not only in Caracas but across the whole country, are on the side of the Constitution. Now, we're asking all Venezuelans to take to the streets to claim what we've not been given as citizens throughout all these years.
Guaido is Venezuela's interim president, and he has the backing of many Latin American countries and the U.S. The response today from the Maduro government was blunt.
No puede calificarse sino de un acto también cobarde.
That's Venezuela's defense minister, Vladimir Padrino, saying Guaido's call to action was, quote, cowardly, a terrorist act and nothing but an insignificant coup attempt. Hundreds of people protested in a few areas of the Venezuelan capital today, including Gustavo Mendoza, who spoke with me this afternoon. Gustavo, where are you right now?
Right now in Caracas, Las Mercedes, which is kind of like nearby Altamira,
and
where everything happened today.
Are there protests going on right now?
Yeah, there are several. Like usually there is like a main location where everybody goes. But right now, because it's kind of like improvised, everybody's all over the place in different places around the city. The call is to stay out in the streets for as long as we can.
What did you see today?
Today was a surprise because we woke up early in the morning with the news that Leopoldo Lopez was out. And so we kind of like got out to the street, like to see what was going on.
Leopoldo Lopez is, of course, one of the main opposition leaders, and he had been under house arrest, and now he's out.
Yes.
And what happened then? Did you head out to the streets as soon as you heard that?
Yeah, I went right where he was, which was like Altamira, right in front of like the military base La Carlota, which is in right in the middle of the city. It's an airport. And he was there with Juan Guaido sitting inside a bulletproof truck. And he was surrounded by, I would say, like 30 military. And they were holding like large guns, pistols and ammunition.
So let me just clear up one thing. The military that you described there with Leopoldo Lopez, those military are people who are supporting Guaido?
Yeah, there was civilians, military, and also police.
And were there any Maduro supporters or military supporting Maduro at that scene?
Yeah, because it was right in front of a military base. And inside that military base, there are, how do you call this military that is in charge of public order? And the thing is that that group of military, which don't have any guns, like real guns, they came very close to where Guaido and Leopoldo López was. And that's when the shooting started. The military that was with Guaido started to shoot to the sky just to clear the space, you know. And that happened like 3 times.
Was there any...
Nobody got hurt.
Are you going to stay out in the streets indefinitely?
Yeah, that's the call. I don't know if... the people will stay out because at night it's kind of like dangerous. But yeah, we're going to try to stay out as much as we can.
The impression we're getting here in the U.S. by watching the news is that the military high command in Venezuela is still supporting Maduro. What is the sense there of the degree to which the military has shifted to Guaido or is hanging in with Maduro?
To be honest, there's no way of knowing this. I mean, it's a big sign that we saw military supporting Guaido today on the streets with guns and shooting against the other military. That, to me, it's a very clear sign that something is happening.
Gustavo Mendoza is a Venezuelan photographer. He's been speaking to us from the streets of Caracas, and he's a Guaido supporter. Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Okay, thank you.
Across town from Gustavo, Mariana Zambrano was at home as protesters were in the streets. She's a doctor doing her residency in Caracas, but she wasn't able to leave home today.
Here in this area, the streets are closed off. There is no access to the main highways, and all the businesses are closed off. Everybody's very anxious about everything that's been going on since 6 a.m. today. I have been following the news very carefully. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it to the protest called today by President Guaido. Right now, there is a pretty heavy confrontation between the military that are against the Maduro regime and the other groups that are supporting him. So I have a very close friend of mine who is right now in the middle of the looting, and it's pretty chaotic. There is not much information accessible to us.
You're not able to see any media or hear any news?
No news. There is no news at all except the news that are said by the government, which have pretty much no credibility for me. So all the information that I can receive is from Twitter. Everything is very chaotic. There is a protest that is heading to Miraflores, which is the center of power here in Caracas. There is a lot of gunshots. There is people that are getting hurt, civilians that are there supporting the Guaido protest.
Are you there alone or are you with family?
Yeah, I'm with my parents. We couldn't leave home today for work, either one of us. By the moment I got up, everything was going on. And as I tried to leave, everything is closed off. I couldn't go to work today. And we're pretty much trying to stay update with everything that's been going on. And waiting. I mean, we're just waiting to see if there is something we can do.
You've been witnessing this whole situation for years. At this point, are you hopeful? Are you worried? What are you feeling?
It's very complicated because there have been many times in this last 20 years where we feel that we're close to returning to democracy, and somehow the government manages to do something and they put people in jail. So right now what I'm feeling is very confused. I hope that we can actually return to democracy, but I don't have the certainty. I wish I did, but I don't.
Mariana, are you scared that things may get more violent?
I am scared that things will get more violent, but I think that somehow there is no other way. If we want to be free again, I think violence is pretty much inevitable because of the position of the government. They won't leave peacefully. So I think it's a necessary evil of sorts. I hope that there are the least number of casualties as possible. I don't know. It's very confusing for us.
Mariana Zambrano, she is studying to be a doctor in Caracas. Mariana, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Later this hour, how years of political and economic crisis led to this potential turning point in Venezuela. Emperor Akihito gave up his throne today, the first Japanese emperor to abdicate in more than two centuries. And to mark the occasion, he gave a brief speech at the Imperial Palace. The elderly Akihito thanked the nation for supporting him during his 30 years on the imperial throne, and he wished Japan peace and prosperity in the new era that begins tomorrow when his son, Crown Prince Naruhito, ascends the throne. Japan has been slowly bidding goodbye to Akihito over the last few weeks. Huge crowds greeted him as he traveled around the country on a sort of farewell tour. My BBC colleague Rupert Wingfield Hayes was there on one of the emperor's last stops.
So I am standing now just outside the imperial tombs in Hachioji on the western edge of Tokyo, and there are thousands and thousands of people here this morning, many of them elderly, but a real mixture, and they are excited in anticipation because the emperor is about to arrive. The emperor and empress will drive past here in a minute. This is one of the last public appearances the emperor and empress will make before the abdication. Here comes the motorcade now. You hear it going past. There's the motorcycle outriders. There's the emperor and empress waving to the crowd. The crowd waving their flags in response. It gives you a real sense here of just how much love and respect there is for Emperor Akihito. And gratitude for the way that he has carried out this very difficult role over the last 31 years.
And this is the last chance for everyone to see them.
Pamela Onodera was born in America, but she's lived here in Japan for the last 30 years.
They do so much good for the country. You see them in the news doing this and that for the good of the people. And it really takes you here.
Kaori Sugiyama says this is the first time she's come out to see the emperor.
I am not from the generation that experienced the war, but the emperor is the one that has kept the peace in Japan throughout his reign. So I wanted to come and see him to show my gratitude. I wanted to tell him, thank you.
All this love and gratitude is not automatic. Many Japanese did not love the emperor's aloof father, Hirohito. But since his 1989 enthronement, Emperor Akihito has set about revolutionizing the Japanese monarchy. At palace events, Empress Michiko takes to the piano. The emperor sometimes accompanies her on the cello. In the aftermath of natural disasters, he and the empress can be found sitting for hours, comforting victims in evacuation centers. No Japanese emperor has ever behaved like this in public before. But it is in foreign affairs that Akihito has left his biggest mark. From Beijing to Seoul, Manila to Saipan, he has reached out to countries invaded and brutalized by Japan during the reign of his father.
Akihito is a huge figure.
Jeff Kingston is a professor of history at Temple University in Tokyo.
He made it his business to address the unfinished business of his father. And so he created a new role for the emperor, and that was as the nation's chief emissary of reconciliation, crisscrossing the region, making gestures of atonement and contrition, remarks of remorse, basically trying to heal the scars of the wartime past.
戦後の長きにわたる
This so-called apology diplomacy and the emperor's unbending commitment to pacifism is not popular with Japan's right wing. Professor Kingston says it has put the emperor increasingly at odds with the political establishment, particularly with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Everything is quite subtle when it comes to the emperor, but clearly Emperor Akihito and Shinzo Abe have frosty relations. They totally disagree about the wartime narrative. Akihito has, referred to the tragedies of the war and the need for pacifism. Abe is trying to rehabilitate that era and promote, a stronger military role for Japan. So they couldn't be more diametrically opposed.
For nearly a decade, Emperor Akihito has been pushing to hand the throne to his son. On Tuesday, he will finally step out of the spotlight, and Crown Prince Naruhito will become the 126th Emperor of Japan. He is thought to share his father's liberal views, but he will have to work hard to earn the love and respect that is so widely felt for his father.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting from Tokyo. Again, Emperor Akihito of Japan has now officially abdicated. His son, Naruhito, officially ascends to the imperial throne tomorrow. Just ahead, the pitfalls of taking your good intentions with you on vacation. We'll look at voluntourism. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Are you hoping to get a break this summer? Perhaps do some traveling? Well, for some vacationers, mixing tourism and volunteering is an increasingly popular option. Voluntourism, as some call it, it's a growing part of the travel industry, with many travelers looking to spend time helping out in overseas orphanages.
They love to go and hug little kids and hold infants and teach children English and all kinds of things.
That's Amy Costello, host of Tiny Spark, a podcast about international aid and development. Costello says volunteering in an overseas orphanage isn't always what it seems.
Many of these children who are in orphanages actually have living parents. These are kids, many times, for whether their parents have died or not, have been traumatized. And so there's very valid questions about whether it makes sense to have a short-term, untrained, unskilled volunteer work with these children closely for a week or two and then disappear, or whether they should have trained professionals dealing with these traumatized children. But of course, money's hard to come by for a lot of these organizations, and so they rely on volunteer staff rather than having donors fund paid positions by professionals.
Let's hear from Sophie Otiende. She works for Heart Kenya. It's a nonprofit focused on eradicating human trafficking. Otiende runs a rehab center for kids who've been trafficked, and this is why she thinks orphanages open their centers to volunteers from abroad.
It's a very effective way of raising money because most of the time these images, when you see a young white person with a baby who's being fed, it's just one of the ways that elicits emotion and allows people to give.
And Otiende goes on to say that allowing tourists or volunteers to work with these vulnerable kids is problematic for a number of reasons.
You have volunteers coming and thinking that they can rescue or they can save or they can assist by offering short-term help. And for the longest time, there's never been a professional critique of that system as to what skills are you bringing to the table, as to the fact that you are coming here to work with vulnerable people who need very specific help, and essentially just being there is not enough.
So these orphanages are actually relying on volunteers for this care, or is it that when volunteers come, they'll be moved to donate money?
Both. This has become an industry, unfortunately, and so we have lots of well-intentioned people around the world who want to work with kids around the world. But what this has led to is an industry, a full-fledged industry, and traffickers have become involved, and there is money involved. Yes, these volunteers will donate their time and their money to help these facilities.
Amy, you just mentioned human trafficking. How does that fit in?
Well, what's happened is there's been such a surge in demand for orphanage volunteer opportunities that this has led to a demand for more children. Again, you know, there are many, many children in orphanages right now who actually have living parents. And so what happens is as there is a surge in demand for these opportunities by the well-intentioned tourists, traffickers have become involved and go to rural, poor communities and promised children and their parents better opportunities for these kids. They can take them to a place where they'll be educated, well-fed, well-clothed. And for a very poor family in a rural part of a developing nation, this seems like an opportunity that they are willing to take part in.
Here's Matthew Morey. He's head of the group Tear Australia, which is part of a coalition called Rethink Orphanages. It's focused on preventing kids from being put into orphanages unnecessarily.
In Southeast Asia, what we're seeing is traffickers will go into communities, poor communities, and tell parents, poor families, that they have an opportunity for their children to get a better education and to get better health care and to get 3 meals a day and to be well treated if they move them to these residential care, these homes, these orphanages. Sometimes the people who go in and do this, who are traffickers, are actually paying incentives, and sometimes the poor families actually are paying them for the benefit of their kids getting these opportunities. But what they're being told and what they're being sold is not the reality. These children are being sent to institutions where they're effectively being used to generate profits from the tourists who are looking to have an experience and are looking to, at the end of the day, feel good about how they've used their holiday and feel good about themselves and feel like they've contributed to a better world.
Is the implication here that the orphanages themselves are complicit in this, that they know that there's traffickers bringing orphans so it'll be interesting to volunteers? I mean, who's the villain in this? Is it the orphanages too?
I mean, I think it's fair to ask, you know, whether we're all villains in this. And it's impossible to kind of characterize every orphanage around the world. And Matthew Morey, in fact, goes to pains to say that some children indeed do need to be in institutionalized care for any number of reasons. And so this isn't to say that every child in every institution across the globe should be there. In fact, there's many who should, I assume. But we can't ignore that many well-intentioned people, any of us who have traveled and who want to work with children, need to just be aware of the unintended consequences of those kinds of actions. And it's not necessarily to blame tourists themselves. I believe that many of them think that they are doing good. But if you step back and look at this, it is, unfortunately, an industry. And now whether particular orphanages are aware that traffickers are involved in bringing kids to their orphanages. You know, again, it's a case-by-case basis, and I think it's hard to paint with a broad brush, but I think it's something that's increasingly on the public radar and is a cause for concern.
But there are cases around the world where, say, a young teen gets pregnant and they're not able to keep their child, or it's frowned upon in their society, and people do still put children up for adoption, and in some countries that means orphanages.
Yes, certainly there are occasions when it's appropriate to institutionalize a child or to bring him or her to an orphanage when a parent is unable to care for it or has died. That doesn't mean that we can turn a blind eye to the fact that this is a real problem and has impacting children and their families through trafficking. And another thing to note is the fact that a well-run institution would never allow short-term volunteers to work with its children. We would certainly never allow that in this country, to allow people from other countries who are visiting the U.S. to just pop into our institutions to play or visit with vulnerable children. And so I think it's a sign, and if we're looking to kind of vet which organizations are responsible and which ones aren't, it's worth seeing what their policies are. And if they're allowing short-term volunteers into their institutions, that might be an appropriate red flag to consider.
Finally, Amy, are groups like Rethink Orphanages making progress in getting a spotlight focused on the link between orphanage volunteering and child trafficking?
Yeah, Rethink Orphanages is a coalition of organizations in Australia who have pushed legislators in Australia successfully to pass a legislation late last year that makes Australia the first country in the world to recognize orphanage trafficking as a form of modern-day slavery. And so they will be instituting a number of measures and mostly awareness-raising campaigns across universities, which send many, many orphan volunteers to places around the world. And this is seen as a real win, and it's one that Rethink Orphanages and other kind of anti-orphanage advocates are hoping will spread across the world to simply raise awareness about this issue and make us become more informed volunteers.
Amy Costello is the host of Tiny Spark, a podcast of the Nonprofit Quarterly. It looks at philanthropy, international aid, and nonprofits. The current episode of Tiny Spark is all about volunteerism in orphanages overseas. You can hear it at tinyspark.org. Thanks a lot, Amy.
You're welcome, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills. Suzanne Alfors wanted people in Sweden to help the environment by changing their travel habits. Specifically, she wanted them to fly less.
So I started this Facebook group because I wanted to make it easy to go by train to other countries.
Sweden's fly-shaming movement ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Much of Argentina is at a standstill today. Labor unions are holding a one-day national strike to protest the government's austerity measures. President Mauricio Macri is cutting government services and slashing price subsidies. That's after getting a fiscal bailout from the International Monetary Fund. Natalia Cosoy is a freelance reporter in the capital, Buenos Aires. Natalia, what's been the impact there in the capital of these strikes?
Well, today, if you go out, it feels a bit like a Sunday in most places of the capital. If you don't go to the epicenter of where the protests are taking place, which is proper downtown Buenos Aires, the rest of the city feels quite quiet. Although there was an expectation that most of the transport should be stopping altogether, but it didn't. And many of the bus lines are working. The metro is not working, but also rail lines do work. So some people, if they wanted to, they were able to get to work. Nevertheless, the feeling is of a quieter day. Again, as long as you don't go to the epicenter of the protest, where things are getting a bit more intense and there's been some minor clashes with the police.
What's behind these strikes?
Well, the key issue here is the economic situation in Argentina. Argentina is facing a very critical situation at this point. Inflation is massive. It's well above 50% a year. We're also living in a recession, a time of recession. Unemployment is rising. And what the unions and many in Argentina are demanding is a change in the policies of Mauricio Macri's government, who they deem responsible for this current situation Argentina is in.
What do they want the Macri government to do?
Well, some in the union question the relationship the country had gone into with the International Monetary Fund. They feel that the fund is demanding the country to cut down on state funding of different areas of the country. So cutting down the fiscal deficit means smaller investment by the state and smaller investment in areas that are sensible for the citizens, as you mentioned in the introduction. For instance, the subsidies for services such as electricity, gas, or other basic needs for the citizens here. So they feel the way the government of Mauricio Macri is leading the country is the one that's made them poorer and unable to get what they want and have the salary they expect to have and be able to consume what they want to consume. It's down to the very, very basics of the daily life. But also, and this is important to mention, it's also a show of power by the unions that might be closer to some of the parties in the country that will be fighting a presidential election in October. So that's also an element that has to be taken into account. And that also explains why not all the unions are taking part in this strike.
I see. But at a very basic level, Argentines are feeling the effect of no more subsidies on certain basic things that they were used to. And so their money's not going as far.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to take one simple example, Argentina is the second country that consumes the most amount of meat, of beef in the world.
Yes, we've heard
Uruguay.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Argentinians now, the consumption of beef is dropping massively. And Argentinians are moving from beef to chicken, consuming more and more chicken because the price is basically because it's cheaper. So changing habits such as that one, that is so much ingrained in the Argentinian culture, is showing how much this economic crisis is impacting daily life. And also people are cutting down on other things, traveling, buying homes. For instance, instead of moving to a bigger space, they might move down to a smaller place only to cut down on spending and be able to make the money worth and useful till the end of the month.
Natalio, have you cut down on your own meat consumption?
Well, not that much yet, but I'm being carefully and watching very carefully where I spend my money. That I can say. And I can also say that people very close to me are watching their money very carefully, like my parents who are pensioners and who are definitely seeing the impact of this cut down.
Have your parents had enough of Mauricio Macri, or are they going to hang in?
Well, funnily enough, they are not sure they would vote for him, but they are also not very happy with the former presidency, so they are really in a tough place, not being sure where to place their vote. And on top of that, I say it's not an exception what they are feeling, my friends. I'd say a big chunk of the population here is there, at least 30%, and not sure what to do with their vote in October.
Journalist Natalio Cossoy in Buenos Aires. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let me throw some popular Swedish slang at you. Flygskam and tuggskritt. Two words that Swedes are seeing a lot on social media right now. Flygskam means flight shame, and tuggskritt is train bragging. Both refer to a noticeable shift in Swedish transportation preferences that has everything to do with fighting climate change. Susanne Elfors launched the rail-only travel site Tagsemester 5 years ago, and since then it's amassed 80,000 members in its Facebook group and a bit of social and political clout.
I would wanted to travel in a sustainable way, and I know that it's more sustainable to travel by train. So I started this Facebook group because I wanted to make it easy to go by train to other countries.
I know there's this other movement, I guess if you want to call it. Is it called Flygskam?
Yeah, that's right.
And Flygskam's all about, does it translate roughly to flight shame?
Yeah, and it's because there is a famous girl here in Sweden, Greta Thunberg. Maybe you know about her.
Yes, yes, a climate change activist, yes.
Yeah, and she is very engaged. And also her mother told last year that she's not going to New Zealand for singing. She's a very famous opera singer. And when she said, no, I'm not flying anymore, people thought, oh, if she can do that, I can also stop flying. Some famous people after her that also told that I'm not going to fly. And then people started to change their travel habits, and it became shameful to go by plane because it's so devastating for the environment and for the climate.
I understand there's another Swedish word that's being used a lot lately, tågskryt, which means...
Yeah, that's the opposite of flygskam. Tågskryt is train bragging.
Do you engage in tågskryt yourself?
Yeah, I think so. And especially people in the group, because they share pictures from their train trips and so on, and then they got a lot of likes.
Your Facebook page for Tågsemester is quite active, about 80,000 users. What kinds of rail-only travel advice and tips get shared on that?
Everything. But it's much like, how do I go to Barcelona? How do I go to Greece? And so on. But there are also other kinds of questions. How can I change train in a certain city? What kind of restaurants do they have at the station? How could I bring a dog on a train? How do I bring my wheeling chair? Vegan food, etc., etc. So there are so many different questions.
Susanna, are you involved in sort of encouraging more high-speed rail and kind of linking up trains and making long trips more possible?
Yeah, kind of. We have changed the situation. In Sweden, the government has decided to put effort on the night train lines to Europe, and they say it's because of the Facebook group, or yeah, it's one reason. So it was not their intention, but the politicians are now listening and they're very interested to discuss with us.
There's literally been a spike in rail travel in Sweden since these various efforts, including yours.
Yes, so it has increased. So they have putting new departures because the interest has increased here in Sweden. And also the domestic flying has decreased. So it's really changing.
What about the serious issue behind all of this, which is climate change and combating climate change? How serious are you about helping in that effort?
Quite serious. I worked with sustainability and environmental issues for all my adult life, but I'm mostly working with housing and how to make residential areas more sustainable. So now I've changed focus a bit to traveling, and I think it's a good opportunity because it's very easy for a person to really reduce their climate impact by changing their travel habits.
Susanna Elfors heads up Tågsemester, a rail-only travel site in Sweden. Thanks a lot, Susanna.
Yeah, thank you.
A language shift has been underway to help resolve the sometimes tricky question of pronouns. More and more, gender-neutral pronouns are replacing he and she. The AP Style Guide now says they can be singular. Scrabble players can use the pronoun Z. And the official Church of Sweden no longer refers to God as he. In light of all this, you'd think the decision of one small maritime museum in Scotland to stop using she to refer to ships wouldn't be a big deal. But you'd be wrong. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
For hundreds and hundreds of years, boats and ships have been called she and personified as female. You'll find it in sea shanties.
Leave her, Johnny, leave her. Tomorrow ye will get your pay, and it's time for us to leave her.
And if you want a more historically precise example, you'll find it in Forrest Gump, when he names his shrimp boat Jenny.
I'd never named a boat before, but there was only one I could think of. The most beautiful name in the wide world.
So it made a big splash, and I swear that's my last pun. When the Scottish Maritime Museum announced on Facebook that it was going to stop calling ships she and instead refer to ships as it, apparently the museum had two signs vandalized that used female pronouns to refer to ships, and they can't afford to keep repairing the displays. By no means is this the first institution to make this change. Lloyd's List, which is a venerable shipping news journal, decided to stop using she 20 years ago, actually. So I have to think that no one would have noticed this announcement if Admiral Alan West, a retired senior official in the British Royal Navy, hadn't decided to make a stink about it on the BBC.
It's a sort of insult to generations of sailors. The ships are seen almost like a mother. You know, they preserve us from the dangers of the sea and indeed also the violence of the enemy.
Tell that to these guys.
Give me some time to blow the man down.
He was broad in the counter, but bluff at the bow.
Those lyrics are, she was broad in the counter and bluff in the bow. I have no idea what that means, but I'm willing to wager you'd never describe your mother that way.
I've studied hundreds of ship logs and diaries, and I haven't seen any references to the ship as mother.
Margaret Creighton is a historian at Bates College in Maine, but she has seen ships personified in another feminine way.
Sailors tend to personify the ship more as a sexual object. You know, they talk about riding the ship, boarding her, owning her, possessing her, having her go into dry dock and have her bottom scraped.
Sounds unpleasant. I mean, you just have to look at those bare-breasted sculptures on the bow of old ships.
And we have figureheads and we have, you know, the sexual objectification taking place during the time when women were completely excluded from seafaring work. So clearly something going on here that, you know, maybe we need to think twice about.
It's easy to make light of this story. And trust me, people have. People like comedian Andy Saltzman on a BBC show.
I mean, the problem is, I mean, it is very traditional. It's very, very hard to tell the sex of a ship. It's gender identity. They're like, in that respect, they're like rabbits or flies or trees or benches. And the reason for that, Miles, is that the ship's reproductive organs are generally hidden within the hull.
But there's a larger question here. We know that women have been historically excluded from seafaring. So in referring to ships as she, are you really empowering women? Or are you just reinforcing the idea that ships are a male space? And if ships are no longer referred to as she, will it make that space more inclusive? For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The diamond is a ship, me lads, for the Davis Strait she's bound. And the key it is all garnished with bonny lassies around. Captain Thompson gives the order to sail the ocean wide, where the sun it never sets, me lads, nor darkness dims the sky. And it's cheer up, me lads, let your hearts never fail.
Back to our top story today, the unrest in Venezuela. The country has faced years of political and economic crisis. There have been a lot of protests, but not a lot of change. Now Venezuela's interim president, Juan Guaido, is once again calling for Venezuelans to take to the streets to oust the government of Nicolas Maduro. The BBC's Will Grant just returned from 2 months in Venezuela. I asked him if he felt like this is a turning point.
I think it's definitely a significant development, isn't it? I mean, we can see that Juan Guaido, for some time now, has been trying to tell his supporters and anybody who'd listen, quite frankly, that there is a groundswell of support that goes beyond what is seen in the streets. I mean, we could see protests in the streets that were pretty well attended. Certainly people said they want change, that they're tired of the lack of infrastructure, the lack of electricity, the water shortages, and that was translating into backing for Juan Guaido. What he wasn't able to do is bring the military on board. And now what we've seen is obviously him flanked by certain sectors of the military. It's difficult to say just how big that force is. And significantly, Leopoldo López, his sort of political mentor who was under house arrest, standing at his side saying, you know, change is coming, the moment is now. So the very fact that they have got Mr. López out of house arrest shows that perhaps his captors or the people around him also sort of switch sides. So it is absolutely a significant development one way or the other. As much as the government's saying it's all calm and everything's under, you know, under control, that's being counteracted by the fact that there are videos all over Twitter of very, very irregular and potentially very dangerous situations.
I wonder if you were in touch with members of the military and can give us a sense of the kind of internal scene. Are there certain factions that you're kind of waiting to see if they turn or not?
Well, I was in Venezuela for the best part of the past 2 months, and previously I lived there for 3 years during Chavez's time in power. What I found on one of the occasions when I spoke to a military officer who didn't want to give me his name and, you know, wouldn't show his face on camera or anything like that, but did talk to me, was that there is a degree of real exhaustion and a rejection of the government among sort of rank and file. This one military officer particularly planned to sort of escape with his girlfriend. He was just going to defect. They were going to take some leave near the border and then cross the border with Colombia someday. So that's, I think, why he was prepared to talk to me. Now, how indicative is he of that feeling within ordinary troops, ordinary soldiers? What's key, and it's very difficult to sit down and talk to them, is that the top brass don't feel that way. Now, whether or not that's because they've also got too much to lose themselves, they're loyal to the revolution, they're loyal to Nicolas Maduro personally, or as one economist I spoke to put it, he said they're loyal to Benjamin Franklin, they're loyal to the dollar. They have economic interests as the army, as the military. And this particular economist suggests, well, that's really why they're staying loyal. It's more self-interest than anything else.
You've reported a lot on the economic collapse that's accompanied this political crisis. How much more do you think the Venezuelan people can take?
It's one of those situations that you think, well, surely now this is as bad as it's going to get, and yet it continues to worsen. There is a strange situation where, you know, the new normal becomes quite quickly adopted and adapted to. So while I was there, these rolling blackouts were taking place, and Caracas, for example, went 5 straight days with no power. As a result, there was no water. Yet, little by little, people adapt. Those who didn't have left, unfortunately, there's been the biggest exodus that Latin America has seen in the past 20 or 30 years. So, you know, it is a critical situation where that sort of final point comes, that line that's drawn that causes people to rise up and demand change is a very, very hard thing to measure.
The BBC's Will Grant, just back from 2 months in Venezuela. Thanks a lot, Will.
You're very welcome.
Nelson is a vulture who was minding his own business, flying his migratory route, when he was taken captive in Yemen. He'd been fitted with GPS before he took flight in Bulgaria, and months later, when he landed in Yemen in the midst of that country's civil war, pro-government forces thought he might be a spy. They took him into custody. Kim Michelle Broderick is with One World Actors Animal Rescue. She's helping to coordinate the care of Nelson. Kim Michelle Broderick, how's Nelson doing now? What's going on?
Well, Nelson is in a secret location with our chief ground ops coordinator in the capital.
He's in Sana'a?
Yes. We're trying to build his strength back up so that he is strong enough to fly back to Bulgaria.
Now, how did this blow up into an international incident? I mean, this has involved some diplomacy to free Nelson. What happened here?
Nelson is a young griffin. He is part of an international scientific research program which tries to bring this endangered species back from extinction.
So he took off from Bulgaria, and that was last fall, wasn't it, around September?
Yes.
And so he leaves Bulgaria, he goes through Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and then gets to Yemen. And then what happens there?
Well, he flies along the Red Sea and then went inland to Taiz, and that's where...
You mentioned Taiz. That's a town in Yemen. That's where he was taken captive?
Yes. Taiz is between the two warring factions, the rebels and the Western coalition forces. So it's the worst place that he could have turned up. And we came across a message from a villager on Facebook saying, hey, we found this bird. Then the police confiscated the bird and jailed him.
Why did they jail him?
Because of his GPS satellite attached to his wing tag that he was an Al-Houthi spy.
So why didn't they just remove the GPS tag and let him fly away?
Well, they did remove the tag and returned the GPS to our coordinator, who drove 18 hours from Sana'a down to Taiz through the mountains, and he presented himself to the police. And he tried to explain that this bird was not an Al-Houthi spy, that he is just a young bird who was exhausted from this long flight, needed rest and food, and because he weighed under 7 kilos, he no longer could take off.
When will Nelson be released and able to continue his migratory route?
We are feeding him for the next 5-6 weeks and also repin the GPS satellite so that he can be tracked.
Kim Michelle Broderick is with One World Actors Animal Rescue, which is involved in the care of Nelson, the vulture who was detained in Yemen out of concern that he was a spy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you.
Here's hoping Nelson makes it back safely to Bulgaria. That's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.